With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast was recorded before the coronavirus and before the 2021 Formula One regulations were delayed, so please excuse some mentions of the rule changes next year.
Throughout the history of motorsport, the drivers have been on the front line of racing, but often their performance depends entirely on a group of engineers. In a special podcast series, we are going to speak to the likes of Adrian Newey, Patrick Head and Gordon Murray about what it takes to engineer the greatest drivers in the history of our sport. Not only will we look at some of the groundbreaking technology they brought to Formula One, but we will delve into the minds of the best drivers the sport has seen. We hope you enjoy the series, Engineering Formula One's Drivers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special Motorsport Magazine podcast series called Engineering Formula One's Drivers. Today, I'm joined by Motorsport's editor, Joe Dunn, on my left.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me. And Adrian Newey. Adrian, this is an extraordinarily busy time of the year for you. We're sat in your office in front of your drawing board. Thank you for sparing the time.
Pleasure.
So today, what we're going to do is we're going to sort of split the podcast in two. We're going to talk about your relationship with some of the amazing drivers that you engineered in your career, and then also going to talk about the sort of more technical side. And we've got lots of readers' questions, which I promise I will get to today. The drivers you looked after and still continue to sort of have a relationship with now, I've got the list here. It's a very, very long list with a lot of world champions in it. If we could just start by, sort of off the top of your head, who did you have the kind of closest relationship with as an engineer and driver?
It's a difficult one to answer. I mean, I think probably Bobby Rahal, who's back in IndyCars. I think for various reasons. First of all, two seasons, but I think more importantly, IndyCar in those days, it was just the race engineer. There was no data to look at, there were no data recorders, so it was very much the relationship between the race engineer and the driver. In that very small environment, three mechanics, team manager, Bobby and myself, then we became very close friends. So we would often go out for dinner during the week. We would typically on a Friday evening kind of discuss the setup and so forth, ruminate over it, and we just developed a very close bond.
As an engineer, is part of your job really a translation service between driver and then actually what you then do with the car? Do you want a driver to come in and say, oh, can we change this and that? Or do you want them to say, the car's doing this?
Yeah. I think if you go back to the sort of old days, which I was right on the edge of that, then it used to be that the driver very often engineered the car from the cockpit. Those days are now long since gone. Although I do encourage our drivers to, if you like, critique what the engineer's suggested setup is and be involved and know what they're doing, because very simple example, you know, driver comes in and says it's understeering, then there's a whole range of things an engineer might do. For instance, he might put more front wing on it, or he might soften the front anti-roll bar. The driver will probably have a feel, and this is particularly the case in a pressured practice session where you haven't got long to discuss it before you've got to get out again, which one will be the right one. So he might think, actually, more front wing is not what I want. It's just going to oversteer too much on corner entry, for instance. So it all depends on that relationship, as I say. Going slightly off piece, because to answer your question, I think very early on, then in my day, then I said we didn't have data recorders. So the driver would come in, and you had to learn his language, or we had to learn each other's language and get that trust in each other. Mika in particular, Mika Häkkinen, had a very different way of putting things, and if you kind of took what he was saying on face value, very often you got lost. If you actually took the time to understand what he's trying to say, as opposed to the words he was using, then you got somewhere. So, as I say, it's personal relationships.
Was it Mika Häkkinen you had a particular problem with in terms of him saying the car's understeering, but actually he was making it understeer in order to... There's something, I'm sure...
That's exactly right. So Mika's a very natural driver. He will adapt his driving style to suit whatever the car's doing, very often subconsciously. So there's a particular example when we first started testing the 98 car, where he was coming in and saying it was understeering, which was pretty much standard for Mika. We kept, in that case, adding front wing, moving the mechanical balance, which is softening front roll bar, stiffening the rear. And he wasn't coming in and saying the understeer is any better, and if anything, his lap times are getting slower and slower. And that's when I realised with him that actually what he was doing is, or what was happening was, he had a nervous car on corner entry. So he was protecting from that, from the rear coming on around on entry, by taking a shallower and shallower line into the corner. So that, by kind of taking that shallower line, he wouldn't be putting as much steering lock on early in the corner entry. But that meant that then when he did finally turn the wheel, because he obviously have to at some point as he's approaching the apex, then he was, the car's pointing in the wrong direction, he's putting far too much steering lock into it, it understeers, and that's coming, what he came in and said. And so that was a very good example of learning to interrogate the driver and try to get out of him what the car's really doing, as opposed to his initial reaction of what he thinks it's doing.
So I was just going to jump in, you're talking about your days in America. I was wondering how important a kind of personal relationship with the driver is, and how well you get on with them, how important that is in terms of how effective you are. I know you've got on very well with Mario Andretti, and then engineered his son as well.
I would have to say, I think it's changed a bit. In those days before data recorders came in, then the only information you had was what the driver said, and then kind of, as I say, discussing with him and trying to understand what it is that's really holding him back, because you get some drivers who say almost nothing, the Finns being the classic, Mika and Kimi. You have other drivers who sort of break down all 16 turns into endless detail, and you get completely lost on, you know, you've forgotten what they're even talking about by the time they got to the end of the lap. So it's trying to work with the driver, and as I keep saying it, but trying to form that bond. And I think when teams were smaller and there were no data recorders, that was much easier than it is now, which is perhaps when your very first question, who did I form the closest bond with? I'd probably say Bobby Rahal, followed by Mario Andretti, the two IndyCar drivers, along with Michael that I engineered while I was out there. Big Formula One teams now, I'm no longer... The last time I properly race engineered was Mika in 98. So I'm slightly one step away. Of course, I listen to everything the drivers are saying, everything the race engineers are talking to them, but I'm one step removed. And now it's a different problem, because with the advent of data recorders, then those will tell you everything the car's doing, although of course not necessarily why the car's doing it. And a lot of what the car does is again down to driver input, so two drivers can drive the car in a different way, come back and have different complaints. Some drivers, Sebastian for instance, contrary to popular belief, to get the car rotated early on, he liked the rear to be really stable, so he is not tolerant of turning oversteer. Whereas Mark Webber, actually, you might think is the car that the driver that want a slightly more stable car, was the opposite. He was more comfortable to have the car moving a bit on entry. because he didn't concentrate quite as hard as Sebastian did on getting the car rotated very early on, which was Sebastian's big thing. So all those slightly different styles mean that you do see differences in driver performance if the car's handling slightly differently amongst teammates.
I've got a question here from David, actually, talking about exactly this. Was there anything from the data or Seb's feedback that could explain why Mark was often better than Seb in the high-speed stuff? I've read that Mark was ace in fast corners, but I don't understand how he often beat Seb at Monaco as well. Was it commitment, a matter of feel, or simply as there being less or no corners to a V?
I think Mark was, generally speaking, quicker and faster in the fast corners. I think he obviously had a very good eye for the fast corners. Mark's weakness, if anything, was tyre management. And that particularly hurt him when we got onto the Pirelli tyres that were more fragile than the Bridgestones before. But Sebastian had a very good technique for rotating the car in the sort of classic open corners that you get in a medium speed corner. Monaco is a different problem. It's quite a unique circuit for many reasons, but one of them is that I think the proximity of the barriers and the nature of the corners means it's not actually about getting the car rotated very early. So that seemed to help Mark's technique input. I would say around Monaco, Sebastian and Mark, there wasn't too much to choose between them.
You mentioned obviously Bobby Rahal, Mario Andretti. Am I right in thinking that you also sort of had quite a good relationship with Damon Hill? Because there's a question here from someone called Matt. Do you think Damon Hill is an underappreciated talent, and how does he rank among the other great names you've worked with?
I had a very close relationship with Damon, and Damon, I wasn't officially Damon's race engineer in 96, but I kind of was de facto, and the same with said with Micra in 98. I think if you are the race engineer, clearly you form a closer bond than if I'm merely the kind of technical director or chief designer or whatever title. So to answer kind of where does Damon rank, I think Damon is a bit of an enigma. I think in 96 we had a better car than anybody else. So his main rival was DC and David Coulthard, who was still in the ascendancy. But Damon had a very good feel for the car. His feedback was very good. And there were days where he was absolutely on the money. You know, I think many people talk about his driving the Western Suzuka in 94, but in 96 he very quietly put a lot of extremely strong drives in. I think with all these drivers, how you then rate against other people, you know, if we'd had, I don't know, Ayrton or Schumacher in the car alongside Damon, where would he have fared? It's academic. Who knows? I don't know.
Joe, when you want to jump in, please do, because I'm looking this way. I can't actually see you. It's as if you're not here. We mentioned a while ago some drivers and how that mentally they're not as strong and they'll get something in their head. And you do see it quite a lot in Formula One. As an engineer, is part of your job to try and make sure these little fission cracks don't appear in their kind of overall performance? Because we've seen so often in history, drivers kind of with a small little something in their minds just kind of ruins a race or might ruin a season. You're engineering the car, but is there also that mental side as an engineer that you've got to try and keep these people in the right direction, as it were?
Yeah, that is for sure all part of the job. I mean, I've always approached that merely as trying to earn the drivers trust and respect, if you like. And so if he feels that he can trust you to do the job correctly and to engineer in terms of setup and race strategy and everything else, the car as well as possible, then that gives him a feeling of confidence that kind of that area of his area is covered. But of course that is only part of the whole gambit. There's all the other bits of kind of, you know, getting involved in silly politics with other drivers like Damon did in 95. Kind of the slight kind of feeling that he wasn't being fairly treated within the team that Mark had in 2010, 2011. You know, all those things, that's something different again.
Now, for all you listeners out there who haven't visited the Motorsport shop, I highly recommend you do, because there's an exclusive 10% off to podcast listeners on all the Adrian Newey products. Available until the end of July, you can get 10% off Adrian's book, How to Build a Car, a model of the amazing Williams FW14B designed by Adrian, and this particular one is even signed by the driver, Nigel Mansell. Just go to the shop and add POD10 at the checkout to claim your discount on these awesome items. So head over to the Motorsport shop and make the most of that now.
Just wanted to ask, in your book, I remember there was a really interesting part where you talked about the tension between, when you're coming to design a car, the tension between the safety aspect and performance aspect, and that those discussions you would have with drivers about whether to strengthen the nose cone, I think was one of the examples you gave, versus the performance. And the driver would always want it strengthened, and you would be thinking, well, we need to be competitive. And I just wanted to explore that sort of tension really between what you wanted and what the driver wants.
Well, I mean, that's, those days happily, I think, have largely gone. And that's one of the sort of things which I do feel the FIA, initially sort of championed by Sid Watkins, has done an extremely good job of improving safety through crash testing, load testing, specifications of the car, to make sure that we have to produce a car that's as safe as it reasonably can be. Go back to kind of the mid-80s, and before, obviously, then it was much more down to the designer of the car as to how he made that judgment between trying to make the car as light and therefore fast as possible, assuming it was overweight, versus a bit overweight and slower as a result. And as a designer, it's something I never enjoyed, trying to get that compromise. I probably went, if I'm honest, I went generally on the light side on the basis that nobody's going to thank you for a slow, safe car.
And does that sort of create a pressure professionally for you then? And how did you deal with that when you were in the 80s and the 90s?
It did. I mean, I guess I was young enough and stupid enough not to really think too much about it. Other than to start discussing, even in those days, that was in IndyCar, about kind of how are we going to get some safety tests in here. But IndyCar at the time, it was too small to be leading how you went about safety through research. Formula One, with its bigger funding, was the more natural route. And it led the way initially. Although IndyCar now, is, I have to say, are doing a cracking job on that. And there's lots of things Formula One probably can learn from IndyCar.
I want to talk about two drivers you worked with at Williams, who had sort of, I would say, quite differing ways of going about achieving the same goal. Nigel Mansell and Alain Prost. With Nigel, he splits opinion, whether that's in the press, the public, or in teams that you talk to, have worked with him. Am I right to think that you are a fan because you knew when he got in the car, that was what the car could do? Whereas with Alain Prost, you know, and he wasn't looking for lap times, and it sort of panicked you a bit because you didn't know where you were.
Yeah,
is that about fair?
I think Nigel was obviously a bit of a Marmite character. I was on the, generally speaking, I mean, he could be extremely frustrating, but generally speaking, I was on the on the like Nigel. He was, I found very, certainly kind of as an engineer, then I found him very straightforward to work with. And as you say, the really good thing about Nigel, by and large, is when he got in the car, he knew he was going to give it everything, come in, and that's kind of where it was. He had the odd sleepy moment. I mean, actually, what turned out to be my first Grand Prix win in Mexico in 91, then for some reason he completely fell asleep at the start of the race, and it was actually Ricardo, that would, although he wasn't as quick as Nigel, that went on to win it. But he was straightforward, he got on with it. The only real row we had was actually about whether to race the active car in 92 or not, because he kind of wanted to just continue with the old car. Alan was a bit more frustrating, less easy to get to know, and particularly in testing pre-season, and indeed at race weekends, kind of leading up to qualifying, he wouldn't worry about trying to put a lap together. He'd just work away at the car and work away at sections of the circuit. And it was only at the last minute he put it all together. And that kind of, before he got used to that, was quite kind of worrying. I do remember pre-season testing in, I think it was Estoril, and we were kind of mid-pack in 93, thinking, Christ, you know, we've gone from being completely dominant in 92 to obviously being a bit too sleepy over the winter and being caught up and overtaken, which wasn't the case. It was Damon still getting to know the car and Alan doing as we just said.
It's Frank Durney actually who tells a story of, you mentioned there that Nigel didn't want to use the active car, mm-hmm. and eventually he realised that it was the way to go. Then and Williams, you spent a long time, because it was a totally different chassis, because the kind of the pipework went through the chassis.
Yeah.
And the mechanics were building up this chassis and car for him, and a journalist came over and apparently Nigel said, oh, they've finally given me an active car. And apparently all the mechanics just downed tools and went to have tea. so annoyed. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, obviously now technical director and things like that, and you, as you said, you're slightly removed from actually dealing with the drivers on an everyday basis. Have you seen differences between current drivers, Max, Alex, and the likes of Damon and Nigel, who were so much older when they got in the sport, and while Max has probably did more races than some of them before he got to Formula One, it must be different dealing with someone who's 10 years younger, you know, who's a third of their life younger, as it were. Has that been apparent, or does it not actually make any difference from yours?
It's a very good question. Certainly it's changed my early years in motor racing. I was always race engineering drivers that were older than me, which is why I initially grew a beard to try and make myself look older. And I didn't really shave that off until I was probably about 28 or so. Whereas now it's most obviously very definitely the other way around. And I've grown it again, I'm not sure why that is. I think one of the things about motor racing is that people grow up very quickly. It can arguably, it's now gone too extreme, where if kids are taken out of school and so they spend their life at a kart track, they end up with no social life, no friends of their own age because they're at the kart track. I do worry that they end up kind of slightly lost, you know, the ones that go on to then be successful Formula One drivers, they can be slightly lost souls themselves because they've had their childhoods taken away from them. And I think if you kind of step back a bit, probably a few readers can see a few that are suffering exactly that problem, or have been, one of them's actually, I think, now been through it, but did go through it. But they are quite mature in how they handle the car. They're used to handling a car. They're used to working with engineers, mechanics, teams basically from a very young age. So if you like, their road dust, their track time, is probably not dissimilar to the older generation who started much later and got into Formula One much later. It's everything shifted younger. And if you take Max as the outstanding current example, why is he 22 now, 23, something like that? And you would never guess it in the way he conducts himself at the racetrack. At race weekends, one of the leaders of the team, and he's as I say, done that. So that rather suggests it's back to this thing of kind of how long you've been in that kind of arena, perhaps more than your actual age.
I suppose with Kimi, when he came in, I think he'd done 16 car races.
And Kimi was much more green. I think Kimi could not have come close to leading a team or being the number one in the team that early on. Come 2005, then he was the number one in the team. But he didn't quite have the gravity at that point that, say, Max has now, despite the fact he's a little bit older by then, I guess. People mature in different ways.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, we obviously want to move on to sort of the more engineering side of it, and we're at the time, but there is a question in here. You were mentioning sort of young drivers getting in. There's a question somewhere in these sheets of paper about your son Harrison and whether you kind of helped with setup and everything like that, which I thought was quite nice. Did you sort of get quite involved as a racing dad with your history?
I try not to.
That's a yes, isn't it?
No, well, it actually depends a little bit on the team. So without mentioning names, we perhaps haven't been as good as we could have been with hindsight at which teams we chose for Harry to drive for. And so the teams that struggled a bit more, then I ended up getting a bit involved a little bit. But I enjoy it to an extent if it's a small team. There's actually the team that he drove for two seasons ago in LMP2, a team called Algarve. Then actually being a bit involved with the engineering there was fun because it's a small little team. The team boss, Stuart, he's a very easy guy, very outgoing guy to get on with. And so that's quite a fun little thing to do as a very low time on my part, but to go along and actually on one of the races end up race engineering because Stuart's race engineer was away or off sick that weekend, so I ended up being Harry's race engineer. So talking to him and his teammates on the radio is quite fun.
We should probably congratulate Harry for his drive over the weekend at Daytona.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, no, he did really well actually. He's mature drivers, I think they're losing power through the night, so we're feeling a little bit of pressure to try and keep the pace up, but they all did a cracking job.
There's a lovely story again in your book about when he was karting and you heard a rival, I think it was Mark Webber, who was giving him some tips, and a rival karter said, "How we don't stand a chance, we've got Webber coaching him and newly race engineering him."
Yeah, no, I do remember that moment. It was at Wilton Mill, which is a kart track kind of not that far from here. And I think, exactly as you say, I was kneeling down chatting to Harry Mark was on the other side kind of chatting to him as well, and this lad came past with his dad saying, "We haven't got a chance, we might as well pack up now."
Now, on to the sort of the more engineering side of it, I wanted to ask you about kind of your role models or the people you looked up to. There's quite an interesting question here from Jan, I think it is, saying the late Dr. Harvey Postlethwaite played a pivotal role in your early career, not to mention a few other young engineers too, who would move on to great roles. Yet interviewers rarely mention him. I would love to hear some of Mr. Newey's thoughts on his influence.
Well, Harvey was, I mean, first of all, he was a really good character. One of those sort of slightly eccentric, but very lovable English public school boys, ex-public school. But just had a great charm about him. And he was very good to me. When I started at Fittipaldi, then I was hired as junior aerodynamicist, which is also, as it turned out, senior aerodynamicist. So it's unbelievable when you look at the hundreds, well, not hundreds, but over 100 aerodynamicists that we're now up to, or the top teams are up to. We're a little bit smaller at the top. Ferrari and Mercedes are certainly over that. And so he gave me that trust to just get on and look at the aerodynamics of the Formula One car. But would always come along and take an interest and kind of see what I was up to. I suppose as a 21-year-old fresh out of university, then having dreamt of trying to get into Formula One as a designer, kind of, I don't know, from when I was about 12, and avidly reading about the engineers of the time, of which Harvey was definitely one. So I end up working for the great man was almost slightly intimidating. And the end of the first week at Fittipaldi's, I kind of, in those days, we still had sort of everybody going off to lunch on a Friday, having a couple of pints and coming back. And because it was my first week, I was very well behaved and sort of had one shandy or something. Came back and there's a little Terrapin building where there's only five or so of us engineers. And then there's a little partition and Harvey's office at the end. And he was kind of leant over his drawing board, kind of like that, looking for all the world as if he's concentrating in intense detail at whatever he was drawing. So I plucked up the courage to say, Harvey, can I ask you a question? And he didn't move, and I came round. Actually slumped head hard against the board. It was tracing paper in those days, so it sort of dribbled slightly, and there was a big wrinkle in the tracing paper. And that was one of the things that helped me get over my sort of slight nervousness towards him.
From only £3 for 3 months, you can get unlimited access to all of Motorsport Magazine's content, both online and in print. To sign up, just go to motorsportmagazine.com/trial. Can you think of other names that sort of were, I think role models is not the right phrase, but people you sort of looked up to when you were younger and wanting to get into Formula One?
The kind of big design names at the time were Harvey, as I say, Patrick Head, Gordon Murray, Colin Chapman, not so much by then, because I think he was more the figurehead than the real chief engineer or chief designer or whatever. And yes, I never really had heroes, but if you said who were my heroes, it would have been those people.
Looking back at your career so far, and I know this is a difficult question to answer, so I apologise now. Is there something you look back on and you think that was probably my greatest achievement in engineering terms? I know you've always been quite rightly obviously a fan of your Leighton House, just because it did change the direction of Formula One cars, and people after that started making them smaller and tighter and neater. Is there anything else? I mean, it can be something much smaller, it doesn't have to be an entire car, but is there something you look back on and think that was a great success in terms of time on the track, but from obviously all from my head?
I mean, generally speaking, it's about the package, which is why the 881 Mark Leighton House, I think, was proud of. I mean, I think the Rebel RB5 as a car that then we were able to develop through that whole V8 era, so all the cars that they're not the RB5, because that didn't win the championship, the following four were all very close relatives of the 5. So I think I'd be proud of that car because it gave us our first proper success here at Red Bull, which, given the sort of, I suppose, on a personal level, the gamble I'd taken in joining a very small upstart team, to get our first win, or first wins that year, was very rewarding to what was a completely new set of regulations. So, and that car, again, I think, had quite a few features on it that then became standard. Going back to four-rod rear suspension made so much better sense. Trip going to side exhaust to blow the diffuser, all those things came in with that car and were subsequently copied. And I suppose, you know, it's that old saying, the sincerest form of flattery is plagiarism or copying, whatever the exact phrase is. So, of course, when it's frustrating when people copy, but at the same time, it's a huge compliment.
There's a really good question here that I quite like. That's here we go, from Peter. When you wander the grid with your clipboard pre-race, what is the best thing you've ever spotted on a rival car that made you wish you'd thought of it?
Made me wish I'd thought of it. Well, actually, the clipboard thing now is a bit of a joke, because we have so many photographs that you can, generally speaking, get it out of photographs. But I still do it just to wind everybody up. And occasionally, it's you do see things from a perspective point of view that's more difficult to see from a photograph. And it's, for me, it's time efficient because I don't spend lots of time looking through all the photographs. But in terms of straightforward copying, I mean, generally speaking, it's looking at what people have done and then thinking kind of why have they done that? And then that can just be the sort of something that sets you thinking about trying to look at something in a slightly different way. So very often it's not a direct copy. I mean, occasionally, of course, you do direct copies, you know. Ferrari, 2 or 3 years ago, lowered their upper side impact tube. We copied that the following year. Other bits and pieces, of course, we just copy because they do happen to work on our car. But very often, if you take something, particularly on the aerodynamics, off somebody else's car and simply put it on yours, as an individual item, it won't work because the aerodynamics are so interrelated that you have to develop a package. If you said what has changed most in Formula One, which is developing a bit from that, then it's actually the technology that we use and the size of the teams. If you know, the car that we build now, we could, I guess, in a way, we could have designed that 20 years ago, but we couldn't have manufactured it. So manufacturing techniques, materials, all the things that we rely on outside industry from, we then use very hard. Same with all our computational modelling techniques, be it aerodynamics or simulation of the car going around a lap, or the software and the hardware that we use for our driver-in-the-loop simulators. Those things didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. So general industry is probably what has changed Formula One the most from a design point of view.
Sorry, Joe, I jumped in there.
Well, just following on really from what you were saying there, I was wondering, has it become more difficult to come up with that great idea and to get that advantage over the course of your career? The sort of the ideas that you may have had in the 80s or the 90s, and now because your teams are so big and there's so many brains working on things, the incremental advantages are so hard to find. Or do you still find them?
No, it does become harder and harder. I think for two reasons. First of all, as you say, because the teams are so big, then it becomes more and more difficult for one person to kind of come up with the big ideas, if you like. The other reason, of course, is that the regulation book has got so thick. You know, the rule book in 88, as far as I can remember, when I first got into Formula One, was probably sort of 20 pages. Now it's well over 100, you know, and it's and that's before we get into all the appendices and all the other technical bulletins that we also have to abide by. So the rule book restricts heavily what we can do, and that is one of the things which I think is so sad about the proposed 2021, well, not proposed now, they're going through 2021 regulations, that it's just ever more restrictive. And to me, that's not what Formula One should be. It should be about finding ways that control performance and budget, but then give as much freedom as possible within those two kind of parameters.
Before we go on to the next question, I should remind you that we have a motorsport shop that is absolutely packed to the rafters with signed memorabilia, posters, books, models, and everything you could ever want from the world of motoring and motorsport. Have a look at motorsportmagazine.com/shop. What's more, as a podcast listener, you get 10% discount on everything in the shop, which is valid until the end of July. Please use the code POD10. That's POD10.
Do you think it's going to be more difficult to do your job with the new regulations in 2021?
Well, I remember when I was at March in, I think it must have been the end of 1982, when the flat bottom regulations for Formula One cars came in, which banned the ground effect Venturi tunnels. And Ralph Bellamy, the chief designer on the Formula 2 car, coming in and saying, well, that's it, we might as well stop wind tunnel testing because aerodynamics are over, it's finished. And cursory look at the 21 rules, then you have all these boxes where you can put bodywork, where you can't put bodywork, prescribed shapes to bodyworks, radius of curvatures, angle changes. I mean, it's a kind of Ben Hur of a regulation book. And as I say, to me, I'm not sure it will achieve what it's setting out to do, but even if it does, it seems an incredibly inelegant way of doing it. Go back to that Ralph Bellamy sort of wind tunnels are banned. I think what will happen is you superficially look at the regulations and you think, oh, it's so restrictive, we can't do anything. But actually within that, there are quite a lot of things you can do, but they will be very, very small. So I think from a spectator point of view, the cars will look, I mean, they already look similar to each other. They will look even more identical to each other. And it'll be about tiny details on the undersides of front wings and the undersides of floors and stuff that nobody will be able to see, but will make the performance differences. So will it converge the performance of the cars? Don't know. I doubt it in the first year. It could mean that actually the performance gap between the front teams or team and the mid-pack gets even bigger. Will it make overtaking easier? Probably as long as nobody finds a loophole around it. But there are other ways of making overtaking easier, in my opinion.
Presumably you're busy looking for those loopholes.
Every team will be, for sure.
I'm worried that there's people outside your office and you've got sort of perhaps much more important things to be doing. So what I was going to do is just take a couple of engineering questions from our readers and then play a quick game of word association with sort of people and things from your past. We're talking about overtaking, things like that. There's an interesting question here from Ari. Would it be possible to have a dirty air quota with the current CFD and air tunnel technology, which would allow technical freedom as long as the weight behind the car can follow the rules? Or is everything so prescribed. Yeah, thank you. I might as well give you this mic and you ask yourself the questions, which would allow cars to look different. So I think the dirty air is one of the problems of the lack of overtaking. I don't think it's obviously the problem. Is that feasible? Would that work in terms of having a quota of dirty air behind car?
It's an interesting idea. Yes, I mean, you could try to put boundaries in and do something along those lines. I think there's probably simpler ways of doing it, but I agree with the principle of, as I said, setting out what do you want to try to achieve, putting down a much simpler set of regulations. What we have for 21 at the moment is effectively what looks in its origins as if it was a mid-90s IndyCar that's then been kind of manipulated and into something that produces a small weight for the following car. But there's lots of other ways of doing that. It's not the only way of producing a small weight for the following car. In the process of doing that, we've got this very restrictive set of regulations. I just think that's fundamentally the wrong approach.
There's a question here from Clay asking about, you know, your vision for future Formula One. If you had a blank piece of paper, you didn't have to answer to any, you know, teams that obviously are wanting to keep things the same, if they're at the front of the grid and things like that, no politics involved, you need to keep the rules as simple as possible, what would be your rules?
I think, first of all, it is absolutely true that we're all spending too much, and that ultimately is going to be potentially the doom of Formula One if the budgets aren't kept restricted down a bit. Because very big budgets are dependent on manufacturers, and by and large, Red Bull obviously being an exception to that, although with our Honda partnership on the engine side. If manufacturers pull out, then Formula One's, or you only end up worst position where you end up with one manufacturer in spending a huge amount of money, then you have a complete one horse race. But there are other, there's all sorts of ways of controlling budgets. To me, the thing that's most appealing is actually to restrict the aerodynamic pipe, so the amount of wind tunnel time, CFD time, which is already restricted, but restrict it much, much more heavily. If you restrict how much research you can do, that shrinks your aerodynamic team. You're probably in the position where you could even think about banning wind tunnels altogether. There are other cars in other formulas that have never been a wind tunnel and been very successful. And then go to some sort of points-based system for how much you can bodywork you can make, how many updates you can do each year, that sort of thing, to restrict your manufacturing size. And then have a much more open rule book with, as you say, a way of making sure that the design of the car doesn't make overtaking too hard. I think everybody, we all tend to have a habit of kind of jumping to the solution before we think, spend enough time thinking about what the problem is, and I think that's what's happened here.
Right. So just before we finish, I've got a few names and things written down here. If you just reply with the first thing that comes into your head, as long as it's obviously repeatable. Starting with Ron Dennis.
It's not that I've got to think for something which is. No, I mean, I think Ron is, he's an enigma. He can be an amazing person and he can be very difficult.
Leighton House.
Unfulfilled promise, really.
Yourself, Adrian Newey.
Lucky to be where I am.
Bobby Rahal.
Top guy, yeah. Very, very straight.
Red Bull Racing.
Just been, I think, what we do here, you know, we don't pretend to be anything we're not. I think we're honest and enthusiastic and just try to get on with being a doing the best job we can.
And then last one, the next 5 years.
That I've got no idea. I'm trying to do other things as well as Formula One. The guys here are doing a great job of kind of picking up. So I still spend time on the drawing board, and I love drawing and I love the technical challenges, but I'm also now enjoying trying to work with the guys more and more to, I don't know if mentor's the right word, I always think mentor sounds slightly condescending, and I certainly don't want it to be like that. But to work with all the engineers out there and kind of discuss things, but then very much leave it to them to draw it. So, you know, some of the bits on this year's, 2020's Formula One car come straight off my board, but there's a huge amount which has come off everybody else's CAD systems, and I'm every bit as proud of those guys' work as the few bits I've done. I think that's part of the fun of it, to see them developing.
Adrian, thank you so much for sparing so much time. You know, before we came in here, you were literally on the drawing board. You're obviously a very busy man, so thank you very much for joining us. It's been a fascinating podcast, as always. Alan, thank you so much for recording it. Joe, thank you very much for joining us. It's great to have the head honcho from Motorsport here and to sort of clean out my act a bit. We're going to be back with lots more of these engineering Formula One drivers podcasts. Do join us for the rest of the series. It's going to be a great one. Thank you very much for watching. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.